Today is Thursday, December 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. 14 people were sentenced in France for the 2015 attacks on a Jewish supermarket and on the headquarters of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, which had published a cartoon mocking Islam.
The one thing that came out in this trial was that these were all radicalized in prison.
Plus an update on the Afghan peace process.
The Afghan government said it expected concrete results in the areas of highest concern.
And developing policies for a sustainable ocean and life on Earth. We'll have these stories and more next. Wednesday, a French court convicted 14 people of crimes ranging from financing terrorism to membership in a criminal gang. The convictions relate to the Islamist attacks in 2015 against the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo in a Jewish supermarket. Reporter Catherine Field is in Paris.
The man who was said to have been the ideological linchpin, he was convicted of actively helping in a logistical role in the attack on the Jewish supermarket. He's been sentenced to 30 years in prison. There are another two who have been sentenced to also long terms, a life term and a 30-year term. They're among the three who are tried in absentia, the three who left France just before the attacks and are thought to either be dead or to still be somewhere in Syria. So it's symbolic because there hasn't been the sort of level of trial for anyone so far for any of these terrorist attacks that happened in France. The other interesting point was that three of those on trial were found guilty of associating with terrorists. They received between 13 and 20 years prison. But the other seven, they were just found guilty of associating with criminals. Now, they were selling guns, they were trading and providing logistics. But the judge said, look, if you sell a gun, you know it's going to be used for something like an attack. This is France. You did know. And they got quite stiff sentences from 4 to 10 years for selling the weapons.
Catherine, the attack that everyone remembers from 2015 was the attack on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. What do we know about the relationship between that attack and those who were convicted today?
What we know is the two perpetrators of the Charlie Hebdo attacks, in which 12 people, including some of France's most celebrated cartoonists, were gunned down, and the man who carried out the attack on the Jewish supermarket, they all met in a French prison. They were all radicalized in prison. All three were born in Paris. They were French. They went through the whole system. What we don't know is the level of communication, the level of planning between them. We know that there was some sort of telephone connections. We know that they'd been in touch. But that is really the extent to which we know about them. What we do know is the two perpetrators of the Charlie Hebdo attack, they claimed allegiance to Al-Qaeda. Koulibaly, who carried out the Jewish supermarket attack, he claimed alliance to Islamic State. More than that, we don't know. And it's unlikely we will ever know, because the two brothers who carried out Charlie Hebdo attack, they were a very close cell, and they really haven't been able, despite what, almost 6 years on, the French authorities have still not been able to find anyone else who was within those brothers' area of trading weapons, logistics, or even financing.
What's been the reaction in France to these rulings? Because it wasn't long ago that the government in France was contemplating instituting laws that would call for the investigation of several Islamic places of worship to look for separatist activities.
For a lot of French people, there's a relief that finally there are some trials for these attacks. There had been criticism that after so many years, there was still no one had been brought to justice. So there was a feeling that, oh, at last justice has been done, particularly in this case. When you mention the other laws that are going through, the one thing that came out in this trial was that these were all radicalized in prison. And that is something that the French have been criticized again and again for, that the prison is where people are radicalized. They're in small groups. These prisons are overcrowded. This has got nothing to do with people who came here who didn't feel they're part of society. This is the bit they've got to deal with now. These boys were homegrown, they were educated here, and they were radicalized inside French state prisons.
That was Catherine Field reporting from Paris, France, and she was speaking to me via WhatsApp. A political delegation of the Afghan Taliban is on a three-day visit to Pakistan to discuss the Afghan peace process. VOA's Aisha Tanzim is following their visit and brings us this report.
An Afghan Taliban political delegation reached Islamabad Wednesday on a three-day visit that includes meetings with the country's foreign minister and prime minister. Pakistan said the visit was part of an effort to facilitate peace talks between the Taliban and Afghan government. Welcoming the move, the Afghan government said it expected concrete results in the areas of highest concern, including an immediate reduction in violence, followed by a comprehensive ceasefire and constructive peace negotiations. The delegation is led by the head of the Afghan Taliban's political wing, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar. Pakistan's foreign minister, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, says he told the Taliban that their negotiations with the Afghan government must provide a comprehensive and inclusive settlement. He also called for a reduction in violence, but said efforts must come from both sides.
This responsibility is not only on the Taliban.
Qureshi was saying that the Taliban could not be single-handedly held responsible for reduction in violence. All sides had a role to play. The visit came on a day when Taliban militants attacked and killed at least 13 security personnel in Baghlan in northern Afghanistan. Violence has surged in Afghanistan in the last few months, with civilians paying a heavy toll. The Afghan government, international stakeholders, and human rights groups have all called for an immediate ceasefire. The Taliban have so far resisted those demands. Analysts say violence is the most potent card the group holds during negotiations. Negotiations between Taliban and the Afghan government officially started in Doha, Qatar, on September 12, 2020, and have since made some progress. The two teams have taken a break from December 14th to January 5th for internal deliberations. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
The global plan to deliver COVID-19 vaccines to poorer countries faces a very high risk of failure, potentially leaving nations home to billions of people with no access to vaccines for not months, but years. Reuters reporter Emily Wither has that story.
Some poorer countries may not see the COVID-19 vaccine until 2024. That's according to internal documents seen by Reuters. They show the WHO's global scheme to deliver the vaccines faces a very high risk of failure, potentially leaving nations home to billions of people vulnerable to the virus. The World Health Organization's COVAX program is the main global scheme to vaccinate people in poor and middle-income countries around the world. It aims to deliver at least 2 billion vaccine doses by the end of 2021 to cover 20% of the most vulnerable people in 91 countries, mostly in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. But internal documents show the scheme's promoters say the program is struggling from a lack of funds, supply risks, and complex contractual arrangements. All of these could make it impossible to achieve their goals. The report says the risk of failure is higher because the scheme was set up so quickly, operating in, quote, uncharted territory. The WHO did not respond to a request for comment.
Emily Wither reports for Reuters News. In this year's Global Competitiveness Report, the World Economic Forum measures the ability of countries to weather and recover from the devastation caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Because of the pandemic and the inability to collect necessary data, country rankings in the World Economic Forum's competitiveness report have been suspended. Instead, it examines the factors that help economies better able to manage and recover from the pandemic. The report notes the deep economic recession triggered by the infection continues to have profound economic and social consequences. While no country has emerged unscathed, some are more resilient than others. World Economic Forum Managing Director Sadia Zahidi says countries with advanced digital skills have been more successful at keeping their economies running during the pandemic.
Countries that have a greater level of digitization across their economies and that have been able to switch relatively rapidly to remote work, those happen to be the countries that fared slightly better, and in particular, their populations, because of being able to maintain their jobs, fared slightly better.
The report cites the Netherlands, New Zealand, Switzerland, Estonia, and the United States as countries that have performed well on this measure. Authors of the report find countries with strong social safety nets and robust healthcare systems also have managed to withstand the worst effects of the pandemic. Zahidi says a number of international institutions advise governments to use stimulus packages to support their economies and workers during this difficult period. At the same time, she says governments should start moving to a slightly more dynamic phase in preparing for the post-pandemic period.
That doesn't mean that governments will not need to continue to do some investment, continue to provide some support. It may not be short-term furlough schemes, but it may instead be longer-term support for safety nets that allow workers to move out of their current roles, to get some income support, to be able to retrain, to reskill, and then move on to another future role.
Zahidi says recovery from the coronavirus for lower-income or highly indebted countries will be more difficult than for the advanced economies. She says an international collaboration agreement is needed to support these countries in the short term so they can move forward. She adds they will need support from the international community for some time to recover from the ruinous impact upon their economies by COVID-19, the illness triggered by the coronavirus. Lisa Schlein, Geneva.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Humankind has used a variety of devices to keep track of and measure time. The U.S. National Institute for Standards and Technology says its atomic clock in Boulder, Colorado is so accurate that it only varies by 0.03 nanoseconds per day, or about 1 second in 100 million years. Physicists at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology say they have designed a new type of atomic clock that's not only more accurate, but could also help detect physics phenomena such as dark matter and gravitational waves. Unlike the atomic clocks of today, which measure the oscillations of random atoms, the new MIT clock gauges atoms that have become quantumly entangled. The website sciencedaily.com defines that as atoms that have lost their individuality and synced up with each other. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. On Wednesday, Hong Kong held its first ceremony to administer oaths of loyalty to China for civil servants. A government spokesperson said the oath-taking would strengthen the public's confidence in politically appointed officials. And to learn more about the ceremony and reaction in the special administrative region, I caught up with reporter Ria Mobile on WhatsApp.
Yeah, so yesterday about, let's say, two dozen high-ranking civil servants took these oaths vowing to uphold Hong Kong's mini-constitution, which is the basic law. They've become the first batch of public officers to fulfill this new requirement to pledge allegiance to the city, which has been introduced under the new national security law that was introduced by Beijing back in June. So under this new requirement, public office holders will make these pledges, and a spokesperson described this oath as being a solemn promise to uphold their responsibilities and genuinely show the Hong Kong community their loyalty and commitment to the basic law and to this mini constitution.
What happens if it's found out if, you know, these public servants refuse or they're found in violation of the oaths? Because if we go back to the pro-democracy protests, There were several civil servants who participated in them.
Yeah. So what we know so far from statements that have been released by government officials is that the government planned to roll out this plan across all departments. So yesterday was just perhaps the first batch. So about 24 people took these vows. They want to, within the next couple of months, roll this out to across all 180-ish thousand people that are civil servants in Hong Kong. And those who refuse to do this could be asked to leave their posts. And those who breach their promise could be violating the national security law, according to this statement that was released by the government yesterday.
Rhea, I'm kind of wondering what has been the reaction in Hong Kong to these oaths being administered?
So the Hong Kong public, I mean, there are mixed opinions, of course. Hong Kong at the minute is very polarized, and that's starting to emerge more and more since last year's anti-government protests. So from what we see, you know, just comments on social media, comments below, news stories, there is a lot of polarization and debate. And some people are in favor of this plan for everyone to take these oaths, whereas some people just have zero trust in the Hong Kong government and see it as just another way that Beijing is encroaching in on Hong Kong. However, on the flip side, there are people who firmly believe that this will strengthen belief and confidence in the government. And these are essentially about the same people who also believe that these new national security laws would sort of bring more peace to the city and put an end to some of the demonstrations, especially the violent skirmishes that we saw take place last year.
Rhea Mogul reports from Hong Kong. Due to climate change, pollution, overfishing, and other factors, the world's oceans are in deep crisis. Scientists say, therefore, by extension, so are we and all living things that depend on the ocean for food, air, and other vital necessities. Although marine and climate scientists have been sounding the alarm for decades, policymakers have usually favored short-term economic growth over the long-term health of the seas. To help address the emergency, the leaders of 14 coastal nations, including Norway, Canada, Chile, Indonesia, Japan, Kenya, Ghana, and Namibia, have formed a powerful alliance called the High-Level Panel for a Sustainable Ocean Economy. It explicitly links the development of best ocean sustainability practices to their economies and the future welfare of all peoples and the planet. To find out more about its work, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with marine ecologist Jane Lubchenco, a distinguished university professor at Oregon State University and one of the Ocean Panel's leading scientific advisors. She is also the former administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA.
The 14 global leaders that have come together as the Ocean Panel have really focused on the role of the ocean for each of the nations involved in the panel, as well as people everywhere. They recognize that the ocean's health is at risk from pressures such as climate change, overfishing, and pollution. And the Ocean Action Agenda really brings a holistic approach to ocean management.
What do you mean by holistic?
Currently, most management is very sectoral. Fisheries are managed by one minister, water quality by another minister, oil and gas or renewable energy by another minister. And the sector by sector, issue by issue approach is part of the problem. We have to be thinking about the cumulative impacts of all these activities. And so the bottom line for these 14 leaders are the three P's: effective protection, sustainable production, and equitable prosperity. They go hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. And so they set out to develop a set of recommendations that could deliver a sustainable ocean economy.
What is new about the Ocean Panel's approach to an ocean economy?
Part of what they are doing is understanding that the old framing of having to choose between a healthy environment and a robust economy is absolutely false. The new Ocean Action Agenda that they are proposing, if it was realized, could provide as much as 6 times more seafood than the ocean does at present by 2050. and as much as 40 times more renewable energy by 2050. It could lift millions of people out of poverty and contribute as much as 1/5 of the greenhouse gas emission reductions that are needed for the Earth to stay within the 1.5 degree centigrade target of the Paris Climate Agreement. So that's pretty impressive and pretty exciting mission that they are on.
I know the Ocean Panel issued 74 pledges to achieve their goals, but perhaps chief among them is the promise by each country to develop and implement a sustainable ocean plan for their own national waters by 2025. That seems like a lot of lead time for something so urgent.
In reality, 2025 is just around the corner for something as big and bold and ambitious as a sustainable management plan for an entire exclusive economic zone. But they are also committing to a suite of other actions that will reform fisheries to make them more sustainable. But we can also be restoring the important nursery areas that these ecosystems provide, and these ecosystems provide barriers against storm surge and coastal erosion.
What else?
They are also committing to clamp down on illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing, which is super destructive, and they are also addressing the flow of trash, pollutants, plastics, nutrients from the land into the ocean, and to tap the power of the ocean to help reduce carbon emissions and address climate change.
The Ocean Panel only represents 14 of the 189 countries that signed the Paris Climate Accord. How is that enough to really make a difference on the crises that the oceans are facing?
The 14 represent 40% of the coastlines of the world, 30% of the exclusive economic zones of the world, 20% of the fisheries, and 20% of the shipping. And you sum up the size of all 14 exclusive economic zones, that's an area about the size of Africa. So these 14 countries are actually pretty big players. And now we are realizing it is possible to use the ocean wisely rather than using it up, but only with bold, smart actions. And that's what these 14 countries are proposing. They've listened to science, they've learned from one another, they've been working together. And I think if their historic commitments are implemented, the resulting successes will catalyze and inspire an explosion of smart actions by other key players, enabling people and nature and the economy to thrive.
Jane Lubchenco was a distinguished university professor at Oregon State University and a scientific advisor to the High-Level Panel for a Sustainable Ocean Economy. She was speaking with my colleague, Adam Phillips. Emmy Award-winning actor Bryan Cranston may be best known for playing Walter White on the FX series Breaking Bad, but the actor recently battled COVID-19 while filming his latest project, Your Honor, now on the Showtime Network in the United States. VOA's David Byrd has his story.
Okay, so it would be the new hospital then. The ambulance would have taken him to what, New Orleans East?
I don't know.
Well, the police must have said something.
I drove away.
Emmy Award winner Bryan Cranston is back as a New Orleans judge, Michael Desiato, whose son kills the son of a local mobster in a hit-and-run accident. Cranston's character originally wants his son to confess, but when he learns the victim's identity, he decides to cover up the accident and keep his son safe at any cost. Cranston, best known for playing Walter White in the Emmy-winning series Breaking Bad, says he was almost finished with Your Honor when he and his wife were diagnosed with COVID-19 earlier this year.
A few aches, achiness, but nothing really to keep you in bed. You're not feeling great. And just exhaustion, pure exhaustion. So I was sleeping a lot then. And then the one last thing that remained was the loss of taste and smell.
Cranston said the infection and the pandemic meant radical changes in the way he worked on the series and how he conducted his personal life.
We were tested 3 times a week, every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. We were asked not to socialize, to go to work and go home. Have food delivered if you, you know, go to the store once a week to pick up your supplies. And so it was very restrictive. And we made it through the 2 months of shooting the final two episodes. And but it wasn't, I got to say, it was efficient, but it wasn't very fun.
The Emmy winner says one obstacle all the cast members had to overcome was hearing other actors through masks and face shields during rehearsals.
It got a little frustrating at times because if someone's supposed to be on the other side of the table and it's an intense scene, you're not raising your voice. You're in, and I can't hear them. And so I don't know how can we remedy this, you know? So it created a lot of new challenges that were unforeseen before.
Bryan Cranston says that his role in Your Honor tapped into a lot of emotions he shares as a parent. But in the series, Cranston has to take his fatherly impulses to a dangerous extreme.
Anything to protect your child. And then I go, would you allow an innocent person to be hurt or killed to protect your plan? And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, no, And that kind, it's perfect for drama. You never want to be in that position in real life. But for drama, it's really good. And my character is forced to make this decision on an impulse.
Your Honor also stars Hunter Doohan as Adam Desiato, Michael Stuhlbarg as gangster Jimmy Baxter, and Isaiah Whitlock Jr. as local political operative Charlie. Your Honor is currently running on Showtime in the United States. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a tremendous Thursday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. maximum pressure campaign against the Iranian regime continues. In November, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced visa restrictions targeting Iranian officials involved in gross violations of human rights, including two IRGC officers, Brigadier General Haidar Abbasadeh and Colonel Reza Pahpi. These men had command responsibility for the violent suppression of protests by security forces in November 2019 in Khuzestan province. Subsequently, the Department of Treasury sanctioned Iranian Minister of Intelligence Mahmoud Alavi for serious human rights abuses against the Iranian people. In addition, the United States imposed sanctions on a huge conglomerate of some 160 holdings in key sectors of Iran's economy that are used by Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei to enrich his office, reward his political allies, and persecute the regime's enemies. In a statement, Secretary Pompeo wrote, "These actions deprive the regime's machinery of oppression, the funds needed to execute its depraved agenda." Also in November, the United States targeted four entities located in the People's Republic of China and Russia for transferring sensitive technology and items to Iran's missile program. The imposition of sanctions against these foreign entities, said Secretary Pompeo, is consistent with our efforts to use all available measures to prevent Iran from advancing its missile capabilities. In a separate statement, Secretary Pompeo pointed out that the maximum pressure campaign against the Iranian regime continues to be extraordinarily effective. He cited Iran's currency crisis, mounting public debt, and rising inflation. He also noted that since May 2018, we have denied the regime direct access to more than $70 billion in oil revenue and will continue to prevent the regime access to around $50 billion annually. As a direct result of sanctions, Iran reduced its military budget by nearly 25% in 2019. The regime's terrorist proxies and partners beg for cash and have been forced to take austerity measures, even furloughing some terrorist fighters. Sanctions, Secretary Pompeo declared, are part of the pressure creating a new Middle East, bringing together countries that suffer the consequences of Iran's violence and seek a region more peaceful and stable than before. Sanctions are a critical tool of national security to preserve the safety of the region and to protect American lives.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.